How do you define magic? Well, a couple of different ways of looking at magic. And how would you try to explain how England, this, you know, the tiny island, or the UK in general, has become kind of the cauldron out of which, if you'll pardon the expression, so much of magic has been brewed? Well, that's what the Book of English Magic is all about. What kind of magic are we talking about? The different forms of magic. Who has done what? And why England? The Book of English Magic, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. Philip Carr Gomm is the author of the Book of English Magic, or should I say the co-author of the Book of English Magic. Tell us about the person who co-wrote the book with you and what his experience is a little bit, Philip, before we talk about you.
Yeah, hi there. Hi. The friend that I wrote the book with was Richard Haygate. He's a Sir Richard Haygate, and he is a businessman. He runs computer software companies and so on, but I've known him for years, and he's very interested in alternative worlds and the world of magic. And a few years back, we were talking together, and we were intrigued about this idea, about the strange fact that you mentioned in your introduction, that England, this tiny little island, seems to have given birth to so much magic. We decided to write a book about it.
Well, I love that. Do you have to call him sir when you talk to him, Philip?
No.
Aren't you supposed to?
I don't think so. Or kneel down.
Yeah. That's what, probably be great. Now, you're a writer. You are also a psychologist. Yeah. You're the founder of an order. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I'm not a founder of it. It's the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids. And
oh, I see.
When I was a kid, my dad worked for the old chief druid here in London. And I first met him when...
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I first met him in London when I was 11 years old. And then as I became... He was a family friend as well. And as I became a teenager, I became fascinated by the idea that there could be druids in the 20th century. And I started to talk with him, and then I began training with him when I was 15 or 16, and I was initiated into his order that he started in 1964, called the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids, that had roots that went way back further than that. And then when he died, after he died, I took over the order in 1988.
What are the obligations of being a member of an order like that?
Well, there aren't any obligations as such, except, I guess, to, you know, behave responsibly and ethically and so on. But the main idea of a teaching order and of a magical order, which the order is to take students into initiation and then to go through a training that hopefully makes you a better person and makes you more opens you up to the potential that you have within you.
You said you started that as a teenager, and of course, for most American minds, probably flashing right away into, was it like Harry Potter? Did you was there a Hogwarts school for you to go to for this school of druidism and wizardry?
Well, of course, you know, real life is never quite as glamorous as the movies. I got very interested in photography when I was young, and I had my own darkroom. And so he invited me to photograph the ceremonies. They used to do ceremonies up on Primrose Hill and Glastonbury Tor. And I used to go along, this was a 15 or 16-year-old, and photograph the ceremonies. And then I would go and see him with the contact sheets, and he would choose which images he wanted to have enlarged. By then, he was in his, getting into his 70s, so he was an elder teacher. And he, and gradually, we started talking about photographs, and then gradually, you know, we started talking about druidry, and this idea that inspired me of the kind of magic of the land, the fact that there were these wonderful stone circles and ancient monuments, and that behind the kind of facade of everyday life, a bit like the platform thing in Harry Potter, that actually... there's something else there to discover that is amazing and fabulous. So I wasn't going into a big old building somewhere up in Scotland.
No.
But it was, you know, looking back, you know, when you're a kid, you just do stuff. It seems kind of natural in a way.
Right.
It's only when I look back now and talk to my friends and, you know, what they did when they were 15, 16, 17, you know, and so on, that I realized it was very unusual. At the time, it seemed kind of the most natural thing in the world. I was just following my nose, really.
Do you have a rank as a druid master or anything?
Yes, I don't like to use it because it kind of develops this kind of top dog underdog thing. A bit like, you know, Richard with his sir. You know, as soon as you start calling somebody sir, it's like they're somehow
right.
better than you. You know, so I do have, you know, it's a chief of the Order of Zaza. You know, but I don't like to use it because, you know, we're all in this together. Really, we're all in the same boat on this funny little planet floating through the, you know,
sure.
universe.
But if you had to whip it out, you could say, "Hey, I'm chief."
Yeah, if I needed to.
Okay, and as the druid master that trained you, when he died, does he disappear like Yoda? I mean, is there anything different about when somebody achieves a level of enlightenment or connection in the druid tradition? Is there a belief about what happens to the soul or the body that's different than most people would have?
Sure. Okay. Not what happens to the body, but to the soul. Where druids believe in reincarnation. This is one of the intriguing things. You know, we think of the doctrine of reincarnation, that we have many lives on Earth, as coming originally from the East. But Julius Caesar, the old classical writers, you know, wrote that the druids also taught the doctrine of reincarnation. And so we believe in reincarnation, at least most druids. I mean, you know, some druids may not, but we do certainly. And my life changed totally 9 years after he died. When my kids, when somebody we know dies here, and my you know, kids say, "Are you sure we carry on, Dad, after death?" I remind them of this story. What happened is 9 years after he died, he came back to me. I was meditating, just sitting quietly. I hadn't maybe thought about him for a long time. You know, it was 9 years later. I was busy. I had a young family. And suddenly he was there in the room. And I didn't see him physically with my eyes. It wasn't like that. But it was, you know, like if you were sitting in your room on your own with your eyes closed and an old friend walked in and just stood a few feet away from you, you'd know it, you'd feel it, and then they'd start
right.
talking to you. And he started talking to me, and he told me a whole bunch of stuff about what would happen and what I should do, and a whole series of extraordinary synchronicities then occurred in the coming years to confirm to me that it was a genuine connection with him. And every so often, he kind of comes back to me and talks to me.
What comes back to you in what form, then? If it's reincarnation, has he been... Are you saying that he was the soul of somebody else's body, or that you were having a sort of a more ethereal experience?
No, well, he comes back to me about like once every sort of 2 years or so, and it's in a lucid dream, so it'll be a dream
okay.
that has that quality, you know, that's
so
different from an ordinary dream. And he's the same. He sort of looks like he's in his 30s or something. But he's the same person, if I can put it that way.
I understand that. But I don't know that I would have put that in the category of reincarnation. We're talking with Philip Carr Gomm, the author of the Book of English Magic. We'll talk more about magic in as the night goes on, but let me just clarify that. So do druids believe in limited or unlimited reincarnation?
Okay, when you say unlimited, what do you mean by that?
That we can come back, humans can come back as a bug. You could be a bug. Limited reincarnation, always human to human to human.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the classical writers said that the ancient druids believed in unlimited reincarnation, transmigration of souls. So that you could, like the Buddhists believe, you know, you can end up a bug if you mess up too much.
Well, I don't know that being a bug would be bad. Maybe a dung beetle. I don't know that I'd want to be a dung beetle, but I don't know that it's a punishment to be a bug. That assumes that we are the highest, you know, that we're the pinnacle of life and existence.
Yes, life might be short but sweet.
Yeah, But now, so when he comes back, when you're having an experience of reincarnation, as you describe it, I would say that lucid dreaming, interesting, or perhaps even, you know, kind of some sort of after-death experience. But I don't – for reincarnation, I would think that would be you're waiting at a bus stop and somebody turns to you who you don't know, or somebody who had died on the operating table 9 years ago and took his soul in, or – somebody who was a 9-year-old child turns to you and starts talking to you like they're your lost druid master. That's how I would think about reincarnation.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the distinctions between druidry and other doctrines is that we don't lay down the details of any belief. So what I find exciting about it is it is possible to have a spiritual way that has certain guiding principles and ideas, but everyone who's following this way is free to conceive of those ideas in the way that they wish. So in other words, you know, one of the guiding ideas of Druidry is that we do have more than one life. How you choose to understand that and the process and the way it works, the details of that, is up to you and your own experience and your own studies and researches. What tends to happen with religions, particularly spiritual ways too, is that they tend to gather around their core beliefs a whole bunch of dogma and detail that ends up by people having to argue about it. Do you see what I mean?
Oh, I do. Yeah. I'm not. In fact, in that way, Druidry sounds a little bit like AA, where you recognize that there's a higher power in whatever form that is that you think that it is. That's how you relate to the others in the room. It doesn't have to be the same.
Exactly. And, you know, what's fabulous about a druid meeting, say when a bunch of druids get together, is everybody believes in a higher power of some kind. But you might have a druid there who is a monotheist who believes in a god, another one who believes in a goddess. Then you might have another one who's a duotheist who believes there's a god and a goddess. And then you have polytheists and pantheists,
right,
and the whole caboodle. But everybody believes in something more than just, you know, materialist reductionism, just themselves, and it works. And
I totally accept that. In fact, I like, in as you write in the book of English Magic, you even address the subject of what is magic from several different viewpoints. Address that if you would, just so people can have a better understanding when we define what magic means. They may be believers in magic already. They never thought of it in the couple of different ways that you have it in your book.
That's right. I mean, I think that, you know, what one of the problems is as human beings, we tend to, somebody says a word like magic or God or whatever, and we tend to think it's one thing. And then as we kind of learn more about virtually any subject, we discover that there's a whole bunch of different ways you can interpret it and different meanings you can associate. And then you become more tolerant of other people's points of view, and you see that actually virtually every subject is full of different kind of ways of looking at it. So, you know, at one level, one way of understanding magic is to see that it's a way of transforming ourselves. It's a kind of technology of personal transformation and change, and of discovering, you know, what our real purpose is in life. But then, you know, and then within that, you have all sorts of kind of interesting ideas about the teaching you how to time travel and how to communicate at a distance, how to use ESP. There's a way in which some people see magic as a way of how you can influence events that happen. That's where you can get into a spot of problems if you try to do that in the wrong way, in terms of attracting different things into your life. You know, some people understand it as a way of controlling and utilizing the forces of nature for living longer.
Sure.
See, there's a whole range of different ways that you can look at it.
How did Sir Walter Raleigh define it?
Uh-huh. Yes. Now, I start off the book with various different definitions. He defined it as a way of worshiping God.
I think that is, as you know, I am a monotheist, but I would say that if there was one definition that worked for me under almost every circumstance, it was magic as a way of worshiping God. In that, it's a way of saying that when if for us to look at the unexplainable, we look at the ineffable, we look at the things which we can't control, that there are forces that are beyond us. And by recognizing that there is magic per se, it's like submitting ourselves to a higher power, to say that it's a kind of worship of God, because we recognize that these are things we just can't quite ever understand and can't ever control.
Absolutely, and with it comes a sense of awe, you know, like wonder that right. Life is awesome, and it's almost like we have a choice as to how we relate to the world. We either think it's problematic and it depresses us, or we say, "Isn't this amazing? And this is, you know, isn't this awesome and wonderful and fundamentally magical?" Which, of course, once you study anything like astronomy or biology or anything, you say, "My God, this is amazing! This is magical!" So that's right. It's a kind of primary position that you adopt towards the world, and that's what I love about it. It's my primary position is, "Wow, this is a magical place." And that's a place of kind of reverence and awe and worship, as you say.
Well, and I started thinking about it in terms of my own faith experience, and I think there are the people that focus on the awe and wonder of the divine are always better off and happier than those people who approach religion with the belief that, aha, now I have a book of spells. The Bible for me will be like a book of spells, and I can read this verse and that verse, and I can bend the world and God's will to fit mine.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's where you get the kind of the problematic side of magic, which we addressed in this book and talk about, where some people try to use magic to get what they want. And that's, as you say, to bend wills, you know. And
right.
That, you really get into some trouble if you do that.
Well, and that is another one of the traditional perceptions, too, is the idea that you will be able to, by your power, your individual power will overcome somebody else's so that they become more like your puppet. Through magic. And that's the dark side of magic, if we were to say, you know, the dark arts from Harry Potter.
Yeah, absolutely. That's it. Yeah.
And so how does one become a practitioner of magic and avoid the dark arts?
Okay, well, the way I think is just as you would in a religious approach, is if you start with approaching it as a way of reverence, a way of worship, a way of awe, and a way of personal transformation, where you're not trying to change anybody else, you're not trying to change the world, you're actually trying to change yourself. It's a, you know, the alchemists who were magicians, you know, that had this wonderful image of changing base matter into gold. And that's a metaphor for changing yourself, your aura, your energy, who you are, into gold, if you like, into light.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is why, you know, in the training program, we have this very comprehensive training program in the order that we kind of mail out all over the world, and that the whole focus is on developing the self and working in that way. And then another safeguard, I think, is the world of nature. If your focus is on loving nature, loving trees, loving the sun, loving the earth, and so on, this automatically puts you in a position of trusting life and of opening to its awe rather than trying to bend it.
Well, I want to return to that concept of the black magic arts versus the white magic arts. But I want to focus first on what is it about England, since that's so much of the book of English magic. And it is. It's the crucible where so much of the world thoughts about magic really have been refined over the years. England, why this island? Why this series of British Isles? What is happening there that doesn't happen anywhere else in the world? And why are these? Why the necessity? Even if one looks at it that way, for magic in the UK. Also coming up then a little bit later on, we'll talk about some of the applications of magic, of how you might even before the end of this show be able to have at your fingertips the ability to perform some kind of magic beyond the pulling the coin behind the odd child's ear kind of magic. Coming up on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So we're talking with Philip Carr Gomm. He is the chief druid and a student of the game, too. Obviously, somebody who studies magic in all of its different forms. The book is called The Book of English Magic. He's written many books. A book on wild wisdom meditations is his. A Brief History of Nakedness, Journeys of the Soul, and Sacred Places, 50 Sites of Spiritual and Religious Pilgrimage. Love that. These are all books I'm reading about on his website. You can link up to Philip Carr Gomm at coasttocoastam.com. And we'll get back to the Book of English Magic. What is it that makes the country of England in particular so thick with magical practices over the centuries? We'll explore that next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponnett. Philip Carr Gomm and I were just talking about his experience with Druidism, what is unique to Druidism, and how we can understand better that magic comes in many forms. But magic doesn't always come from many places. There's some places that it doesn't seem like magic is much part of the tradition at all, or at least depending on how we define that. Let's think about England for a minute or so, as this is the Book of English Magic. So why the British Isles? What is so unique about the geography, the topography, the meteorology? What is it about England that lends itself to centuries of eccentrics and scholars focused on the occult?
Well, one way of understanding it is the rational one, and the other is a kind of slightly more romantic and esoteric one. The esoteric one says, hey, look, Julius Caesar talked about how the British Isles were this magical island. It was once called the Island of Merlin, the Island of the Strong Door, off the coast of Europe, where the Druid tradition developed, and it was the land of magicians. And then since then, there's been a secret history. And one of the things our book has tried to do is chart the course of the secret history that occasionally pops into view and that people are familiar with, but all the time it's bubbling away behind the surface. And I'll just, just give you one flash that when it pops into view is Dr. John Dee, Queen Elizabeth I's astrologer, who was a magician and an alchemist and so on, and we know a lot about him and so on. So every so often you realize that behind the scenes at a kind of very high level, magicians are at work. And then to give you the more rational everyday explanation is just the historical one, that somehow England and the British Empire came, people fanned out from the British Empire, they went to India and Egypt and all sorts of interesting places and brought back elements which all went into the pot to cook up all these various different kinds of magic. And in addition, English culture developed with a kind of a liking of eccentricity. You know, there wasn't this thing of, if you step out of line, there's something weird about you. English people actually like it if you're wild and wacky and a bit eccentric. And so that culture fostered that. And in addition, of course, what happened is the language came to dominate the world in one sense. And so you have a combination of those reasons which might explain why it's become a crucible for all these magical traditions.
I love the thought that in England over centuries, there's always been some form of this magical thinking going back into antiquity. Do we know what the origin is? I mean, have you been able to trace sort of the proto-druid, if you will, or how it the first domino in all of this magic English thinking?
Well, of course, like any history, the further back you go, the less information you have, and the more you move into the world of speculation, which is why, when you read the book, we start off with this idea of the landscape and the caves and the initiation caves and so on. And gradually, as the book carries on, each chapter gets kind of layered on top of the next. You get more and more information as you move into the present day. So, you know, who knows what that first domino was, but you can imagine the ice sheets, which came down about two-thirds of the country, you know, as they started to melt and the tribes started to move back from who knows where, but perhaps, you know, the Iberian region, perhaps from the Caucasus, even, you know, the theories of Indo-European origins, where perhaps from way over in India with the ancient cultures of the Indus Valley and all the rest of it. Whatever it was, all these people were working with magic because they were looking up at the stars and all the mysteries of life. And magic, at one level, is about the relationship between darkness and light. You know, what's more magical than seeing your child being born or watching a plant grow out of the soil? Something emerges out of the darkness into the light, and there's a magic in that. And it's not a question of the darkness being bad or having to reject it. In fact, if you didn't have it, the baby wouldn't come out of the womb and the plant wouldn't come out of the soil. So right. It's not about bad and good. It's about these two dynamics that work together to create life. So you have the very first glimmerings, I think, you see in the caves. When, you know, we know from the wonderful caves in France and Spain, and there are some in Britain as well, where they just started to realize that they were painted, but because of our climate here, the paint has come off, so they've only just kind of realized this, is that people would sit in the darkness, and then they would be born into the light. They would emerge out of the cave, and there would be ceremonies and so on. So I think you can say that the very first, you know, magical activity occurred in caves. And then what I do, right at the beginning of the book, we say, you know, in a way, you fast forward to the 18th century and look at Freemasonry, which at its heart is a magical activity, although a lot of it has become social and charitable now. And you see, you know, in the initiation, people are blindfolded, and then they're in the dark. And then at a certain moment, the blindfold is taken off at the moment of initiation. You know, same concept. I'm in the dark, and coming into the light.
Well, you can certainly see that in the symbolism of Freemasonry, that any place that puts a big emphasis on symbols, I think, kind of evokes runes, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of the same concept is that when you're dealing with a lot of symbols, it becomes that they have their own runic significance. And I see that in Freemasonry, and runes is very much part of the very earliest understanding of magic, too, correct?
Sure. I mean, as regards, you know, one thing to make clear is when we talk about England being the most magical place in the world and where most of the, you know, a high proportion of magic has come out of, what we don't mean is that it's all English. What we do mean is mature, because England actually is a country that has been invaded and colonized and developed over the years. It's a whole melting pot of different cultures and groups over the years, but what's happened for some strange reason is that just within this little country, about seven or eight of the main streams of magic that are even practiced in the world to this day have grown in this culture. But they've been informed by, say, when you're talking about the runes, you know, by the, you know, Germanic cultures and from the Anglo-Saxons and so on. They've been informed by cultures outside of England, but it's in England that the cooking has been done, if you see what I mean.
Right.
And then the food has been exported.
Well, I think that may be then one way to understand it fully is that England, which is a country the size roughly of Alabama in the United States, but with a much higher population density, that you would, if you had something new or there was something that was catching fire with the people in such a densely populated smaller area, it wouldn't take long to reach a kind of, to use a modern obnoxious term, a kind of market saturation where everybody would know about it. And then also being a country that was from the very earliest days focused on exploration and being apostolic about the English experience, where people were leaving England all the time to form colonies and go to other places and exporting out what was English, that would be the sort of that natural 1-2 punch of why magic might spread more easily in England. It reached a higher percentage of the population faster, and then it left faster than other countries in England's sort of early exploration and then later domination of the world.
Sure, I think that's right. Yeah.
But thinking about the book of English magic, we're talking with Philip Carr Gumm. I do want to go back to something you said, though. You were talking about the kinds of magic or the kinds of people that were coming into England. Can you follow, for example, a thread of Norse magic with the, you know, with the Viking domination of England and
sure.
later occupation?
I mean, maybe it would be helpful if I explained the kinds of magic that developed in England.
Let's do that.
Know what we're talking about.
Yeah? Sure.
And what's interesting about, as I run through these, there's just seven or eight of them, and as I run through, the other interesting thing that we wanted to bring out in the book is how there are people today who are practicing all these different kinds of magic. And so what we did is we interviewed practitioners of these different kinds, and we sprinkled the interviews through the book. So even though something is very old, there are still people who are working with it. And of course, now in the days of the internet and modern communications, the other thing we did in the kind of resource guide is we found that actually you can learn about all of these online or through books and so on, even today. So the first one is Druidism, the Druids. And Julius Caesar wrote that the Druids in France and in Ireland, when they wanted to perfect their skills, would travel to the heart of Druidry, which was England, mainland Britain. And then you had, shortly thereafter, you had the Anglo-Saxons coming in, and they came from, from Germany and northern Europe, and they brought with them the runes, which for half a millennium were developed in England and formed the basis of a kind of magic there, and there are still people working with that kind of magic today. And then you had, you were talking about the Vikings. Then, of course, you had the Vikings coming over and colonizing, certain parts of Britain and so on, and they brought their magical traditions. Then you had the development of witchcraft, and that's a huge area sort of historically. Now Wicca, which is a kind of variant of witchcraft, a kind of modern re-expression of it that happened in the middle of the 20th century and is now very big in the States as well. You've got that whole current of magic, and then you had in the Victorian times you had the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. It's just when Egypt was starting to be discovered, and a lot of people, some people say that it developed in Germany, but actually almost certainly developed in the British Museum in London, and it was hugely influential, an era of Victorian ritual magicians. Out of that came that infamous man, Aleister Crowley, who developed a kind of magic that has become quite popular among certain people.
You don't sound like you're anxious to claim Aleister Crowley.
Yes. I have very mixed feelings. Well, not mixed feelings. I don't like his the way he conducted his life in the slightest. However, when you're writing a history, you have to include everybody, even if you don't like what they did. If you're writing,
Well, I want to unpack that a little bit because he comes up from time to time on Coast to Coast. And, some people focus on the fact that he was a Luciferian or they consider him to be a devil worshiper, although there's a difference between the two, as I understand it. And then there was this other side to him that we now know better, too, that he was also a spy and he had all sorts of other, activities going on in his life. But is it the Luciferian piece that makes you uncomfortable?
The piece that makes me uncomfortable is that it seems like, one always has to be cautious, because, I didn't know the guy. I actually met somebody the other day who knew him when he was young, and they said he was a wonderful, warm raconteur and all the rest of it. But if you read the biographies of him, he seemed to be extremely cruel. I mean, he ended his life as a drug addict, addicted to heroin, poverty-stricken in England. So whatever magic he was doing, it didn't work for him. And he, he engaged in acts which were cruel, and cruel to animals and cruel to people. And that's why I don't like him. But I do recognize that he was one of those larger-than-life characters who gathered together a lot of information from the Far East and from all the magical traditions, and in that sense, he was a key figure in many ways. But the person I prefer is a person who arose around the same time called Dion Fortune, who was a woman who studied psychology and psychoanalysis and took some of the magic of the Golden Dawn, and she developed a whole current of magic that's very popular now in the world today. And then just finally, to finish our list, we have chaos magic, which developed sort of based on the ideas of chaos physics and so on, which has developed in England over the last sort of 40 years. And those are sort of seven different kinds. If you can add on Freemasonry, there's a kind of debate about whether Freemasonry arose in Scotland or England. But Freemasonry is certainly, as I said, a magical at its heart. So you have those kind of magics there, and those are the ones that a lot of people are working with around the world even today.
You know, you mentioned chaos. I would say that there is a strong vein in Western Judeo-Christian thought that seeks to make order out of chaos, that the biblical understanding of our role is to use our faith as a way of galvanizing ourselves to make order out of chaos, and that chaos is by nature, it is of the devil, so to speak. It always seeks to reorder the world so that one can never depend on anything or anybody, and therefore, the experience we have as human beings is chaotic and unpleasant. Whereas, if we seek to order the chaos, then we can raise families and we can have communities and we can do things which are beneficial to both ourselves and to society. So, I mean, is that the same sort of experience within Druidism or within the magical thinking?
Sure. Well, I mean, notice, for instance, with us, we are the order of bards, Vates, and druids. And so the concept of order, I think you're right. We need a level of discipline and order in our lives. But I think, chaos, the idea of chaos being of the devil is perhaps, there would be a different way that we would understand that, is that a bit like the interplay between darkness and light. Chaos is needed, I think, if you track the creative process. You get an idea, you get this one idea, hey, I'll write this book, there's this subject or whatever, You then go through a process which feels chaotic. So I get very excited when I get a commission to write a book. I start researching it, and there's a certain point, and I recognize it, where it feels chaotic. I've taken in a whole load of information. It doesn't seem to all come together. I feel uncomfortable. It's not a nice feeling. If you stay with it, that's the kind of matrix out of which gradually some kind of pattern starts to form, and then order comes out of chaos, and then you get your book or your painting or whatever. It's when people get stuck in chaos, or when people, I think chaos magic, I mean, I don't do chaos magic myself, and I think it's an unfortunate term. My life is one way is I'm seeking to get order out of chaos. And I'm a very full and kind of, it's easy for my life to become chaotic just because of all the commitments that I have. So for me, immediately the word chaos magic puts me off. However, to give them credit, they're not working just with the forces of chaos. So maybe it was an unfortunate term. They were trying to get a term that related to the ideas of sort of new physics and so on.
And I think that may be what ultimately I think where philosophers, where theologians, I know at least for me, where I feel like I am at peace when I come to understand that despite all of my attempts to use order, to use everything at my fingertips to create order out of chaos, that I find myself at my most happy when I realize I am living in the tension between chaos and order, and I stop trying to bring too much order to the chaos and let a certain amount of chaos exist happily within me.
Exactly. I agree with you. The thing that came to mind as you were saying that is kind of some kind of family party where you invite all the family over for a meal, and you have some idea about what you want to do with everybody. You want to show everybody, a movie or your pictures or something like that. And there are a bunch of kids there and relatives and all the rest of it. And at a certain point in the evening, you just surrender to the fact this isn't going to happen. Your idea of how you would order the evening. And you just enjoy that kind of nice, kind of warm chaos that sometimes a family, particularly with children, can bring.
I promise not to keep bringing up the Bible so much. But it is an interesting tension for me between the book of Proverbs and the book of Ecclesiastes, whereas Proverbs makes things very orderly and says, if you do X, then Y will happen. And Ecclesiastes has a much darker kind of jaded sense of, you can try all you want, there's going to be, you know, chaos wins in the end, kind of an outlook. And it's kind of fun to try to hold both of those in tension with each other. We're talking about the Book of English Magic. He's a chief druid in England, Philip Carr Gomm. It's a really fun book, and it explains a lot. And we'll get more of that coming up. What about English magic? What is so unique about England? And more about the history of how England has been shaped by magic next on Coast to Coast.